are in month 2 of 2024 already. The year and the news feels like it's moving fast. I'm Jessica Marshall, and we will try to hit the slow-mo button and break it down a little here on The Eagle this week. With the presidential campaign season in full swing, former President Donald Trump has emerged as the frontrunner for the Republican nomination. He hasn't declared a running mate yet, and probably won't until July when the convention takes place should he get his party's nomination. But there's already rumored to be a short list of vice presidential options that Trump is considering. One of the names on that purported list may be North Country Republican Congresswoman Elise Stefanik. Stefanik is running for re-election in her district, though. Should she get the VP nod? What happens to her congressional race? The Times Union Capitol Bureau's newest member, Dan Clark, joins me now to discuss that potential scenario. Hey, you are the newest member of the Capitol Bureau. We're so excited to have you here and have you here on The Eagle. Tell us a little bit about yourself and what you're going to be doing here with us at the Times Union.
Sure. So I'm Dan Clark. I am brand new at the Times Union, covering state government, politics, and policy based down at the state capitol. So I'm going to be doing a few things for the Times Union while I'm here. First, I'm going to be working on a newsletter about state government politics and policy. And what we want to do with that is really give people an inside look at the state capitol that they might not get anywhere else. And then we'll be hosting live events too with some of New York's top newsmakers. And I'll also be doing some feature stories for the paper, you know, when issues present themselves.
What, you don't have more than 24 hours a day at your disposal to do all of those wonderful things?
If I did, I would use that, believe you me, but 24 hours isn't enough right now.
Well, someday we'll invent some kind of a time turner. But for now, again, we are so glad to have you here. You've already, you know, you've already written a couple things for us in the short time that you've been here thus far. And one of the ones that I want to talk about is one that you just published this week about Elise Stefanik, Congresswoman Elise Stefanik, potentially at this point being in the running to get the nod for vice president by former President Donald Trump. But she's also running for her seat in Congress this year. And you know, kind of dive deep into the conflict that that creates. So can you tell us a little bit about that? Just give us kind of a 35,000 foot view of what the situation with Stefanik is right now.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So we should start by saying that there's no confirmation that the former president is going to pick Elise Stefanik to be his running mate, but we wanted to kind of explore what that would mean for the 21st congressional district. There are a few things that we do know right off the bat, right? So Elise Stefanik would not be able to serve both as a member of Congress and as the vice president. That's just not allowed under New York state law, and it wouldn't be allowed in general. So what we wanted to look at is what happens if she's running for Congress in the 21st district, and then she does have to pivot and become that vice presidential nominee. And it's a complicated legal process that plays out in New York from time to time. And it's not one that is necessarily, too complex for her in what she would have to do on her end. But it's worth noting what would have to happen. So in June, we have the primary for Congress in New York. Congresswoman Stefanik is facing a primary challenger, and it's assumed that she would win because she has support in the district. So if she does go on to become the Republican nominee, then what happens if she becomes the vice presidential nominee? Well, if she gets that nomination at the convention in Milwaukee at the Republican National Convention, after she would do that, then the party would have to file a certificate with the State Board of Elections. And then after that, they would be able to substitute her on the ballot back here in New York.
So say, in, you know, hypothetically, she gets tapped to be Trump's VP candidate. She absolutely has to drop her bid for Congress from that point forward, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're just two incompatible offices that she wouldn't be able to take. So what she can do is this legal process called, you know, declining a nomination. It's not a very complicated process, but she does have to file paperwork with the State Board of Elections, basically saying, hey, you know I won my primary, or if, you know, the other candidate drops out, she knows that she's the Republican nominee, but now she has to, you know, drop that and become the vice presidential nominee. And that will give the party back here in New York the chance to replace her on the ballot with somebody.
So how does that work? Local officials nominate somebody?
Yeah, exactly. It's very straightforward. So state law doesn't allow for another primary election. So this wouldn't be something where the governor sets a special election, a primary election, and Stefanik's opponent gets a do-over with somebody new. There wouldn't be a new primary election. Instead, the committee chairs, the Republican parties for upper district, would all come together and meet and decide on the new nominee. Once they've taken a weighted vote on that, they can then tell the Board of Elections who that's going to be.
Now, we saw this, or a similar situation, because it's not exactly identical, but a similar situation play out with Congressman Sean Patrick Maloney in the Hudson Valley, right? Very recently?
Yeah. Yeah.
Tell us how that all went down.
Yeah, and that's actually what interested me in the Stefanik situation, too. I covered the Maloney case when I was reporting at the New York Law Journal in 2018. And what happened there, it's a very different set of races, but a very similar situation. So Sean Patrick Maloney was running for Congress in the Hudson Valley. He's a very well-known congressman, and he's not in office anymore. But he was running for Congress in the Hudson Valley. Then former Attorney General Eric Schneiderman had to drop out of the race for re-election to his position. That set off a kind of firestorm in New York politics, where a bunch of people wanted to be the next New York State Attorney General. Sean Patrick Maloney was one of them. But there was that similar conflict. He was running for Congress, and everybody knew that he couldn't both be a member of Congress and the State Attorney General. So he had to pick one of those. So residents from the Hudson Valley actually sued Sean Patrick Maloney to try to force him to pick one or the other. And they weren't successful in court. Instead, the court said that Sean Patrick Maloney, he could run for Congress until he would win that Attorney General primary. And then he could decline his nomination to Congress. Now, that didn't end up working out for him. He didn't win the AG primary, so he didn't have to do that. But that's how that worked in 2018 as well.
Interesting. Okay, so back to Elise Stefanik. You know, as you said before, she's on kind of a short list of potential nominees that could get, you know, tapped by the former president as his VP. That doesn't, like you said, doesn't guarantee that she gets it, but, you know, it makes her more likely than, you know, me or you to get tapped for it. So, I mean, what, you know, in your estimation, like, what are her chances of getting tapped?
You know, she's definitely more likely than a lot of other Republicans around the country. The thing about Elise Stefanik is that she has, always, since she started supporting the former president, has kept that support. Other Republicans have gone back and forth about it, you know, sometimes issuing statements against him, sometimes issuing statements in support of him. Stefanik has really grounded her support. He's also spoken really favorably of her before, but we also just don't know what he's looking for. Is he looking for somebody to balance the ticket? We don't really know if that's going to be the case with Stefanik. She is also considered a very deep conservative, as Trump is. So if she pairs with him on the ticket, he may also see that as a weakness because he's not going to be able to win over those moderate voters that he's going to need to win the general in November.
All right. Well, we'll check back with you, I'm sure, many times before both the primary and the general election. And I know that this will definitely be a topic of conversation. So thank you so much for joining us and welcome to the Times Union.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
You can read more news about state government and politics at timesunion.com/state. You can also get that news sent direct to your inbox. Sign up for the Capital Confidential newsletter at timesunion.com/newsletters/capital with an O. We're going to take a short break now. When we return, the Central Warehouse has been handed its fate. And by all accounts, it will be a long, slow demolition. Stay tuned.
If you're enjoying this podcast, take advantage of all the Times Union has to offer and support our efforts to bring you award-winning journalism by becoming a Times Union subscriber today. Go to timesunion.com/subscribe.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Eagle, a Times Union podcast. I'm your host, Jessica Marshall. There's a new chapter in the long saga of the Central Warehouse. It's the beginning of the end. The former cold storage facility, built in 1927 and defunct since the late 1970s, riddled with asbestos and literally crumbling to the ground, will be demolished. But the logistics of tearing it down are complicated. Times Union reporter Steve Hughes joins me now to explain exactly why. So you reported this week that the fate of the central warehouse is sealed. It's gotten a death sentence. It's going to come down. But what does that actually mean? Like, literally, what happened this week?
So what happened is the news broke that Redburn Development Partners has decided that they cannot salvage the central warehouse. And they have decided that they're going to, at some point, demolish the building. So what that means is two things. First, the city gave back a $9.75 million state grant they got that was supposed to help them rehab this building. That also means that they're going to turn around and at some point this year reapply for that same grant just for the demolition purposes instead.
How much money are we talking about here for demolition costs?
That's the big question. The building's going to come down. No one has expressed any more interest in rehabilitating it. So the question is, how do we do it and what does it cost? And in talking with Jeff Buell of Redburn Development, his estimate that he's received so far is anywhere from $8 million to more than $20 million.
Wow. That's a hefty price tag for the is that normal for the destruction of a building, or is there?
It's not a normal building.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. There are special considerations, right, because of things like asbestos. Like, why is it so expensive?
So Jeff said that it'll depend on a couple things. First, yes, there's asbestos in that building that has to come out. That was going to come out whether it was rehabbed or demolished. The question is whether they can, quote unquote, clean the concrete to be recycled as clean fill. If not, then it has to be sent to a landfill somewhere. And Jeff was very clear on this, that he's trying to figure out a way that they can recycle this concrete so it can be used in some other purpose. He was on the record saying that he thought that was really wasteful, but they're not sure how they're going to do that yet. And they're trying to find firms that can help them with that. If that's the case, then it might be as low as the $8 million figure. If they cannot, then we might be looking at $15, $20, $25 million to tear down a building.
I mean, it almost seems like a drop in the bucket, though, compared to what it was looking like it was going to cost to rehab it, right?
And that's one of the factors that made Redburn decide that they had to take this route, right? Jeff cited three figures to me. The first was interest rates are higher. It's simple economics. The money does not work when they're planning out what they're going to get. The second problem is the cost. They were looking at a figure of $120 to $130 million. And a big factor in how they were going to redevelop the building was tax credits. But when they got in the building, they realized that the outer walls, the facade, was so far gone that they were all going to have to be replaced. And that called into question whether they were going to qualify for the tax credits they needed to make the project work. The other issue that they have cited, and the city cited this as well, is last year, the city's common council passed a requirement that would increase the number of affordable housing units within all new apartment buildings. And what they said was, and the larger the project, the greater the percentage of affordable housing. The city is trying to, the city council is trying to prevent the density of affordable housing in certain neighborhoods, basically spread it out throughout the city so you do not keep all of your affordable housing in specific neighborhoods. But what Redburn and the city are saying is it makes large projects just untenable. The numbers simply don't work when they go to the banks. I don't know if that's specifically true, but they're saying that is certainly the case here.
Just to rewind a little bit, they were, because I know you've reported on this before, when this, you know, Redburn first kind of came into the picture with the central warehouse, they were trying to convert it into what? Housing and like apartments, lofts? Like, what were they trying to do with it?
They had sort of three steps. They were going to do, it was certainly going to be apartments, but they were also looking at some commercial and retail space as well. And one aspect of the plan that Jeff had that was, he thought was very cool and I think would have been interesting if they could have done it is that building sits right along a railroad line. And it used to be a cold storage building. And there's actually like a railroad spur that goes right into the building. And so they were looking at how to make that, incorporate that and keep that in part of the building is like how you get in and out of the building to move throughout the city? How do we attach this to the Livingston Avenue Bridge when that new bridge is built? So he had this vision for really connecting this huge eyesore in the city into the city's future, and how it connects to the waterway and how it connects to the Livingston Avenue Bridge. And at the end, they decided they just couldn't make it work.
Do you think that they felt pressure from maybe the county or the city to kind of make that decision at all?
No. This, I think, was actually Jeff was the one pushing the city and county to let him take a shot at rehabilitating this building. He was the only person who had the vision to try and take this on. They supported Jeff. You know, the city applied for this grant to help him. The county seized the land for back taxes and opened up the bidding so that a developer like Jeff could have a shot at it. But they certainly weren't at any point pressuring him, from what I've learned, to say, Jeff, you got to take this down. This was Jeff and his partners looking at the economics, looking at what they had, and saying, we can't make this work. And at that point, I think everyone agreed, it's time to go.
Yeah. But also the former owner, Evan Blum, kind of inserted himself, or at least, you know, made a statement after, you know, you reported this week. What did he have to say?
Yeah. Evan is an interesting character. But I called him because I thought it would be interesting to see what he had to say. Evan bought the building from a dollar in 2017 from Sunmark Bank. At that point, the property had...
He bought it for a dollar?
Well, it had $250,000 in back taxes on it.
Ah, okay.
Which he never paid a dime of and continued to not pay. At the time that the county seized it for him for back taxes, there was well over $500,000 in back taxes on this property. He had multiple code violations. The city of Albany has brought a multiple code judgments against him. He owes them something like $80,000 in code violations.
Wow.
But I called Evan because he has been adamant that it is still his building and that the county improperly took it for him. He has actually filed a federal lawsuit against the county to be properly compensated for that seizure. That litigation is still ongoing. And Evan, unsurprisingly, says, I can fix this. Just give it back to me. Have a conversation with me and I can make this work. I do not see a world in which that happens, but he is steadfast in his belief that that building is something that he could still turn around.
He made it known.
Yes, he did.
Okay, so its fate is sealed. It's coming down. Is there, I know they have a lot of money to sort out before that happens, a lot of structural, a lot of like things to take into consideration. Is there any sort of projected date for this?
I couldn't say. So there's so many moving parts that have to happen, right? The county would have to apply for this Restore New York grant to get money to demolish it. If they don't get it, they're going to have to go find a different pot of public money to take it down. Because Jeff, and I think the county is behind him on this, says we as Redburn cannot afford to take this down. So then it comes down to, well, once you have the money, is that enough for the costs? And if not, where are we getting the rest of that money from? And then there's all the agencies that you have to work with to get this down, right? There is a Amtrak line that runs 20 feet from that building that's owned by CSX. There's permits for the Department of Labor to get the asbestos out of that. I'm sure the DEC is going to be very interested in your plan to take it down so that all that dust doesn't go spilling out into neighborhoods and into the Hudson. I cannot imagine the complexity that they are going to have to come up with to take this building down safely in a way that does not disrupt railroad traffic, that does not damage nearby businesses and homes.
Wow. My brain is hurting just trying to wrap myself around these, all of these issues. This is a like a boondoggle. Is that the right word for it? I don't know. Like a hot mess, whatever the word is.
A hot mess always works when you're talking about the central warehouse. But yes, that's a story that
we're a cold mess.
A cold storage mess. But that's something that we're trying to figure out, is talk to demolition companies and say, hey, if you had to do this, what would be your approach? And how do you even knock down a building that its roof is an acre? Its walls in some places are 6 feet thick with steel running through the concrete. How do you knock this down and how do you do it safely?
I wonder if there's anything else in the country that you could draw inspiration from, like something like this that surely there's something like this that's happened before. I don't know.
People who are much more well-versed in explosives and demolitions probably have a much better idea of how you do this. But yeah, I'm sure somewhere somewhere in the country, they've had to take down a thicker block of concrete than this one.
Yeah. Well, if there are explosions, I guarantee you we will have video of that happening.
Multiple
right?
videos.
Yes.
I think at this point, the question is, what's the cost and how much public money is going to go into taking this building down? That is something that everyone agrees on in the private and public sector is we are done with this building. We tried to redevelop it. We couldn't make it happen. And now it has to go.
All right. And you'll be following that. We will check back with you for more updates. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
As always, head over to timesunion.com or to any of our social channels. That's Facebook, Threads, Instagram, and YouTube to read more about everything that we discuss on this podcast. That's it for this week. We will be back next week with more from inside the newsroom. The Eagle is a production of the Times Union. It's produced and edited by myself, Jessica Marshall, with help from the Times Union digital team and the newsroom. Special thanks this week to Dan Clark and Steve Hughes for their contributions to this episode.